So, I'm going to get started now because we've got quite a bit to cover with this. As you can tell, we're going to talk a lot about logic right now. Primarily ways you can use logic to build up your own arguments, as well as ways you can use logic to spot fallacies and loopholes in your opponent's argumentation and then argue against them. So I want to go off just starting off with how you can build up arguments with logic. First thing I want to mention is definitions. Definitions are one thing that you can use to help build up the logic in your particular case. So there are a few different purposes for a definition. Does anyone have any ideas what the purpose of a definition would be? Abby?
So we know what we're talking about.
Alright, so we know what we're talking about to sort of provide some clarity for the round. Other ideas. Did you have one, Morgan? Oh, same, okay. What's another purpose of a definition? James?
To not just give clarity, but also to give an edge, give more of an edge to your case.
Okay, to give more of an edge to your case. To limit the resolution. All right. So here are a few. Definitions can show relationships. If you're trying to establish a relationship between two different terms, you can use a definition to help establish that relationship. They can remove ambiguity. Abby mentioned providing clarity to the round and sort of helping us understand what these terms mean. That's this whole concept of removing ambiguity. So we're able to understand these terms as they should be used in that round. The third purpose is to reduce vagueness. Sometimes you can have a definition that might have multiple meanings, and you want to make sure you pinpoint exactly which meaning you're talking about. And at the same time, you don't want to have a vague definition either. You want to have one that's very specific to that meaning that you're discussing. Definitions also kind of increase vocabulary. This one isn't as applicable to writing your cases, but it is one just to keep in mind. Explain theoretically. Definitions can be useful for explaining theoretical concepts, philosophical concepts, and other types of ideas. This is going to be especially useful in Lincoln-Douglas debate, where the entire debate is focused on your value. It's focused on the philosophies and the ideas. So you're probably going to need definitions, whether formal dictionary ones or just sort of an informal explanation of a term, to help clarify that theory. And then finally, definitions can be used to influence attitudes. The particular definition that you choose to use for a term or the particular explanation that you provide is going to be part of the key to influencing your judge's attitude either for or against your own position. A couple things to think about when you guys are using definitions in your case. First of all, make sure that your definition is clearer than the term being defined. If the definition is not helping to clarify that term at all, if it's too long, if it's too convoluted and has too many different aspects to it, it's not going to be that much helpful to have a definition in place. You want to make sure your definition is neither too broad nor too narrow. You certainly want one that isn't so broad as to encompass every possible meaning out there, so narrow it down, but you don't want it so limited either that it provides very little room for argumentation. So you want one sort of in the middle. Don't repeat the term being defined. That's something else that I know some of us can slip into the habit of doing if we're not really thinking. But obviously, if you're trying to define a term, you're not going to be able to define it simply by using the term being defined. So you can't say a government is a body that governs the people. Well, then what do we mean by govern? Because that's part of the original word. You have to define that further then. Try to find a definition that stays away from that and specifically clarifies the term being defined. try to make sure your definition is stated positively. So instead of having a definition that states what that particular term does not mean, state what it does mean. So instead of saying something like a nation is not this, your definition should be a nation is this, and then provide that sort of a positive definition so that we know what it is as opposed to simply what it is not. And then finally, don't have figurative definitions. I've seen that before where people try to be creative, bring up an analogy or some other simile or metaphor to define. When you get into the realm of figurative speech, it doesn't help with definitions at all. You want something very clear, very literal, and very much specific and to the point when you're using a definition. The reason why I bring up all of this about definitions is that it's going to be a crucial part of your case. Not just at the beginning where you provide that list of terms in the resolution, but as you go throughout your debate case, you are to some extent defining the different philosophies and ideas that you're bringing in. You're defining the attributes of the value that you're presenting. You're defining the relationship between your case and the resolution. So it's not always going to be a formal dictionary definition per se, but the explanation that you use is part of this whole concept of defining these ideas. Make sense? Hannah.
Should you avoid having multiple definitions for one concept? For example, if your meta framework is that government equals individuals, and then you go on to your definitions to explain that the government is also a democracy. Is that okay, or should you try to combine those into one and find a different meta framework, or switch the definition altogether?
Typically, you're just going to have one definition for a particular term to make sure everyone's on the same page. One of the problems with presenting multiple definitions is that your judge wouldn't really know at that point which one you want him to accept. You want to stick with a definition that is going to support your case and one that provides enough ground for the debate to occur, of course. So generally speaking, you want to just stick with one definition. James.
We just did a logic class. Shouldn't also the definition be the same part of speech?
Okay, that's another point to make. That's a good one. I didn't have it up here. The definition should be the same part of speech. Basically, what that means is if the word you're defining is a noun, define it with a noun phrase. If it's a verb, define it with a verb phrase. So, let's see. What's one I can think of? A government, we'll just stick with government since that's a fairly easy one to define. A government would be an organization. Government is noun, organization is a noun, and then the rest of your definition would describe that organization. You know, it's an organization that does this. You wouldn't say a government is governing a nation or ruling a nation, because you have government a noun, ruling a verb, and it doesn't quite match up. So that's another good point to bring up. Try to make it match up so that makes more sense.
If your opponent presents a definition that doesn't provide ground for the debate, should you point that out to the judge?
Yes. Point out to the judge that your opponent's definition is biased toward one side or another, and does not provide enough room for the debate. That's definitely something you want to point out, and that's where you would bring in a counter definition as well, one that should be much more objective and able to provide room for both sides to debate. All right. The next thing here, as far as using logic to build up your own case, are syllogisms. How many of you guys have heard of syllogisms before? How many know what they are? All right, someone explain syllogisms to me.
A equals B, B equals C, that's right.
That's an example of a syllogism. What is a syllogism itself? It does follow that process of A equals B, B equals C, A equals C, but can you give me sort of a definition of a syllogism? Yeah, I guess you could work with that. You know, sort of a logical link between different premises. Did you want to say something? Oh yeah, logical flow, logical reasoning, exactly. For those of you who have taken logic before, what are the three components of a syllogism, the three parts to it?
Major premise, minor premise,
Yes, major premise, minor premise, and conclusion. So I'm going to go over these terms really quickly so you understand how this logical flow works. The first is the major premise. This is the premise of the syllogism that contains the major term. All right, really quickly, I want to point out to you guys, this is an example of probably not the best definition to use. The term we're defining is major premise. The definition uses the word premise and major. It doesn't really help us too much. So I'm going to go into a little bit more depth with this. The major term specifically is the term in a syllogism that is the predicate of the conclusion. Now, what's the predicate? Something that is affirmed or denied about a subject. All right, so just to break this down a little bit, Andrew said A equals B, B equals C, therefore A equals C. A equals B is this part, the major premise part. All right, now one of those two terms, either A or B, is going to be what we call the major term, or the predicate. That's what is being affirmed or denied about the particular subject at hand. I'll give you a couple examples in a little bit just so that you guys can see this in a more practical sense as opposed to an abstract sense. The minor premise then is the B equals C part. That's the next step of this logical hierarchy. This is the minor term. So the minor term is going to be the second term you see in the syllogism. It's the subject of the conclusion. So from the minor term, we get, or from the minor premise, we get the subject of the conclusion, and from the major premise, we get the predicate of the conclusion. Do you guys understand the concepts of subject and predicate in terms of English grammar? Do you understand that distinction? All right, so when you have the sentence, he ran. He is your subject, ran is your predicate, right? That's how it works in English grammar. The same sort of thing is going to work when you get down to your conclusion. The minor term is going to be the subject of your concluding sentence, and the major term is the predicate of your concluding sentence. So if all this terminology gets a little bit confusing, think back to just the basic structure of an English sentence and how that subject-predicate relationship works. In your conclusion, this is going to be the sentence that logically follows from the major and minor premises. A couple examples here. One of the more common examples is, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Have you guys heard that one before? Yeah? Okay. So, all men are mortal. What part of the syllogism is that? Major premise. All right, so all men are mortal is going to be your major premise. Socrates is a man. That is?
Minor
premise. Therefore, Socrates is mortal becomes your conclusion. All right. To break down a little bit more of what all of this entails, your major premise, you have all men are mortal. The whole concept, the part where it says all men is going to be what we call the middle term. That's a word that's present in both the major and minor premises. But the predicate that we're talking about here is the word mortal. Okay? So that word mortal is going to appear in your first sentence and in your concluding sentence. Socrates appears in your minor premise, in that second sentence. That's the subject of your conclusion. So that appears in your second sentence and your concluding sentence. So this is where you get, the logical flow of A equals B, B equals C, therefore A equals C. I know a lot of this might be a little bit confusing, especially to those who haven't taken logic before. The reason why I mention it, though, is because in a debate round, yes, you're not always going to be thinking in terms of the rigid structure of a syllogism. But if you understand sort of the basic process of how syllogisms are constructed, if you understand that logical flow from one sentence to another, it will help with your thought process. It will help you as you're writing your own cases and sort of structuring arguments, and it will also help you to recognize flaws in your opponent's case. On the next slide, I'm going to have a few other comments about syllogisms and just a couple of the types of statements you can get with syllogisms, the different types of statements that you can expect to see. We call them propositions. And this is just a really brief overview right now. I mean, if you want more, go research logic on the internet. You can find everything about syllogisms on there. But just to talk about propositions really quickly, there are four main types of propositions that you're going to see. And to some extent, every statement made in a debate round can fit one of these models. It's not going to be stated exactly like this, but manipulate it a little bit and you can get it to fit one of these four categories. The first is what we call the universal affirmative. All S equals, or all S are P. S standing for subject, P standing for your predicate. So this is when you have a statement, it's a very general statement being made about everything falling under that subject. So if your subject is man, and your predicate is mortal, you know, all men are mortal, that's a statement that's applying to everyone in general. It's universal. So it applies there, you know, there aren't any individual exceptions. It applies to everyone universally. And the affirmative part of that means that it's affirming a positive aspect. You know, so all men are mortal. It's not saying they are not something, it's saying they are. You have the universal negative, which is the direct opposite of that. You know, no men are immortal. Once again, it applies to everyone in general, it includes everyone, but this is a negative statement. There's also what we call the particular affirmative, which only applies to a certain group of items, a certain group of people, a certain group of animals or other items, whatever it is. It's just a particular group and it doesn't apply universally. Likewise, the opposite of that is the negative form. So I don't want you guys to get too overwhelmed by the intricacies of the syllogistic format and all these different propositions, but I present this so that you can start to think about it, maybe do your own research into syllogisms and how they work, because when you start combining these different propositions into syllogisms and logic, you know, some of them are going to be valid and some aren't valid. You know, you can draw conclusions from arguments. You can make arguments that are going to be reasonable, but at the same time, you can make arguments that aren't going to be reasonable. And if you understand a little bit about how a syllogism works, how it's put together, it can help you identify which arguments are more reasonable and which ones aren't. Examples of particular affirmative and negative. You could say, for this one, the particular affirmative, you could say some animals are mammals. That's one thing you could say. Not all animals are mammals, but some of them are. So it's a trait that applies to a particular group. In the same way, your negative could be some animals are not mammals. You know, we see birds, we see reptiles, we see all the other different categories. And so that's an example there of where it's only applying to one particular group. The main thing I wanted to focus on in this lecture, though, is attacking arguments through logic. Can anyone tell me what is a logical fallacy? This is going to be a lot more fun than syllogisms, I promise. But what is a logical fallacy? A bunch of you raised your hands for taking logic classes, so please help me out here. James?
If I'm remembering correctly, logical fallacies are things that they really do not follow the laws of logic.
Right.
Basically, they break the laws of logic, but they're not necessarily nonsense.
Okay. Tyler, you want to add?
There are common types of arguments that are made to look like logic, but actually not.
Okay. I like that. So a logical fallacy is a misconception resulting from incorrect reasoning. Did you have something to say?
Yeah, but that would be like straw man's ignorance.
Yes, yeah, we'll talk about some specific ones in just a minute.
Gotcha.
But a logical fallacy is a misconception. So this is where something may look logical on the surface, but in actuality, there's a break in the logic. You know, it doesn't completely follow. And so we're going to look at some of the most common logical fallacies. First of all, I wanted to break these fallacies up into about three different categories, and we'll go through each category in turn. First is fallacies of reasoning in deduction. Deductive reasoning, it follows from what we were just talking about with syllogisms. You have a conclusion that follows directly from those first premises. All right. So basically, the argument that's made in the end is going to follow from whatever you talked about in the beginning. So it should be a very logical progression, like A equals B, B equals C. That conclusion, therefore A equals C, follows directly from the first two statements. Then there's inductive reasoning. Inductive reasoning is specifically about drawing general or universal principles from particular instances. So this involves looking at a particular event or a particular fact, and based upon that instance, drawing out of it a universal principle. A lot of fallacies can result from inductive reasoning, specifically because when you're looking at one particular instance, you're not really considering all the possibilities at hand. You're just looking at that one time. So we'll definitely be looking at fallacies under this category. And then we have other informal fallacies that we'll get to after that.